Every Woman is a feminist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 52% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The opinions and views expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI board, staff, volunteers, or sponsors of KKFI and the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated. And I'm Amy Bell, and I'm here with Sharon Lockhart. And after we do a special end-of-the-year, year-in-review, instead of the usual cheers and jeers, we're going to talk about Sheffield Place and what you can do to kind of make sure your holiday giving doesn't stop at the end of the holidays.
United Nations Women, Gender Equality, 2014 Year in Review. From the passing of one of the Arab region's most progressive constitutions enshrining women's rights, to changes in legislation to provide long overdue redress to wartime survivors of sexual violence, this timeline is a selection of some of the gender equality achievements, milestones, and noteworthy moments from around the world this year. On January 22, 2014, Morocco's controversial rape marriage law was repealed. An article in a penal code that enabled a rapist to skirt prosecution if he married his underage victim is unanimously repealed by Morocco's parliament. The move comes 2 years after 16-year-old Amina Al-Falili committed suicide for being forced to marry her alleged rapist to uphold her family's honor. On January 26th of 2014, Tunisia's new constitution enshrined women's rights. Years in the making, Tunisia's constitution got the seal of approval enshrining women's rights and laying the foundations of a new democracy. Considered among the most progressive constitutions in the Arab region, it states that all citizens, men and women, have the same rights and duties and are equal before the law without discrimination. On February 11th of 2014, the Winter Olympics, women finally compete in ski jumping. It only took about 90 years for women to finally be allowed to compete in ski jumping at the Winter Olympics, held in the Russian Federation's Sochi this year. Why so long? Apparently, women risked damaging certain organs, including their uterus, falling out during such an exertive event, and we can't have that, or so the story goes. Needless to say, women jumped high, all organs intact at the end. On March 11, 2014, Latin America and the Caribbean put women at the helm. Michelle Bachelet is sworn in for a second term as president of Chile, and even before she begins, announces a record number of women to her cabinet. Isabel Allende also becomes Chile's first woman Senate leader. Later in the year, Dilma Rousseff wins her second term in office as president of Brazil, while women remain significantly underrepresented as heads of state and heads of government globally. Latin America and the Caribbean is the region with the highest number of women elected to these most senior offices. March 20th, 2014. Reparations for wartime survivors of sexual violence. For the first time, Kosovo amended a law that will offer redress, including health, housing, and employment benefits to survivors of sexual violence during its 1998-99 conflict. By presidential decree, a high-level national council was established to bring together key actors and stakeholders towards an improved coordinated response to support the survivors. A month later, Uganda's parliament passed a resolution that acknowledged for the first time the need to provide gender-sensitive reparations to the women and men who suffered at the hands of the Lord's Resistance Army during the 20-year insurgency in northern Uganda, including crimes of sexual and gender-based violence. Both achievements come after years of advocacy by civil society and the UN system. On April 1, 2014, the United Kingdom mandated hospitals to record FGM cases. British hospitals under the National Health Service started logging cases of female genital mutilation, or FGM, for the first time. The effort is part of a larger government initiative to evaluate the scale of the problem in the United Kingdom and to combat the practice that poses devastating health and psychological effects on women and girls. The NHS estimates that more than 66,000 women in the United Kingdom today
have suffered FGM, and more than 20,000 girls under age 15 are annually at risk, although experts suggest these figures are much higher. While the practice has been outlawed in the country since 1985, the UK's first prosecutions on FGM went to court this year. On April 15, 2014, India recognized transgender people as third gender. In a groundbreaking move, India's Supreme Court ruled that transgender people, also known as hijras, are a third gender. This means that transgender people can legally be recognized in official documents, such as birth certificates, passports, and driving license, at the federal and state level as transgender. Another victory for the rights of transgender people is hailed in November when Malaysia's appeals court overturns a Sharia law that bans cross-dressing. The court calls the cross-dressing ban discriminatory and against its federal constitution that guarantees personal liberty, equality, freedom of movement, and freedom of expression. June 10th to June 13th, 2014, a global summit to end sexual violence and conflict galvanized unprecedented attention. In the largest summit of its kind, more than 1,000 high-level government officials, experts, NGO members, and activists from across the world came together in London to establish practical steps to combat sexual violence and conflict, seek reparations for wartime survivors, and to bring perpetrators to justice. Co-chaired by then-British Foreign Secretary William Hague and Special Envoy to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees Angelina Jolie, the summit brings unprecedented public attention to the issue. On August 1st of 2014, a European Convention on Ending Violence Against Women comes into force. A landmark Council of Europe Convention on Preventing and Combating Violence Against Women and Domestic Violence comes into force after receiving the required 10 ratifications from countries in the region. This legally binding instrument, commonly referred to as the Istanbul Convention, obliges governments who have signed on to take concrete steps to counter all forms of violence against women, from domestic violence to female genital mutilation. On October 11th of 2014, a record number of women on UN Security Council. Making history, women comprise for the first time more than a third of the UN Security Council's 15 seats this year, with ambassadors from Argentina, Jordan, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Nigeria, and the United States. In a positive move towards increasing the number of women in leadership roles at the UN, on peace and security issues, Norwegian Major General Kristin Lund is also appointed as the first woman to head the UN peacekeeping force in Cyprus and assumes her duties in August. On September 20th, 2014, Emma Watson delivers transformative speech on feminism at the UN. As UN Women's recently appointed Goodwill Ambassador, Emma Watson launches a global solidarity campaign, He for She, calling on men and boys to become allies in achieving gender equality. Delivered at the United Nations in New York, Watson's inspiring speech, stressing that gender equality is your issue too,
Well, what do you suppose happened there?
I don't know.
Well, unfortunately, it was going along pretty good, and then it just turned into gibberish to me. I don't know what happened there, but let's go ahead with the show, and maybe later we'll have some time for people to call in and ask some questions, make some comments about the year in review.
And, well, let's move forward with
Kelly Welch.
Kelly Welch. From Sheffield Place, and let's just start out by telling us a little bit about Sheffield Place and what you do, what services you offer. Very interesting founding story, I understand, as well.
Sure. Well, we were founded about 24 years ago because in Kansas City there was not a place for homeless moms to go with their children. So a couple of agencies that serve those populations, Metropolitan Lutheran Ministries, the Y, got together and started Sheffield Place. So we've been in business since then. We're in a converted Y. It's about almost 90 years old down in the Northeast that used to provide homes for the mine workers, not the mine workers, the steel workers when they were in Kansas City. So we've been at that location, and we currently serve 14 families. We're getting ready to expand to 17. And to get in, you just have to be a homeless mom with your children, or be in your last trimester of pregnancy, or if your children are not in your care, if they're in foster care, you have to be getting them back within the next 30 days, because our program is specifically for families.
And are there unique challenges to families? I mean, what services really extra needed for the families?
The families that come to us because they're homeless, typically. That's the main reason they're calling. But really, the most of the families that we see, it's generational poverty, addiction, unemployment, domestic violence. They grew up in families, a lot of them, where there wasn't stability and where there was a lot of movement. About half the women last year were either in foster care or were runaways. Many of them grew up with substance abuse in their family, in their family of origin. So there are many barriers for them to be successful and self-sufficient. And so we provide supportive housing, but then we also provide mental health services and case management services and therapy for the kids and group therapy, and try to make it comprehensive to address all those barriers that they're dealing with.
From what I've seen, that's kind of a unique approach to homelessness and getting people back on their feet. There's still a lot of people that talk about homelessness in terms of people needing to just get a job or...
Right.
You know, what they need to do better, and you're taking it from this approach of they've already had a pretty hard life, and what can we do better for them?
Right. You know, I think that one of the things that sometimes people don't realize or have to take a minute to think about before they realize is that there's this whole big pool of people that have to deal with homelessness. And I think the stereotype is the homeless guy standing on the corner flying a sign. And that's what a lot of people think when they think homelessness. I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, almost half the homeless are families with young children. I think that a lot of times we think of homeless families and then we think, oh, we've had a parent lose a job or they were evicted. You know, they're just a job away from being okay. The families that we serve have multiple barriers, and it's not just one thing that's going to help them be self-sufficient. There's a whole menu of services that they need to kind of get solid, get, you know, strong enough to then move forward and take care of themselves and then their kids. So we're really, at Sheffield Place, our whole goal is self-sufficiency for our families. We want them to be able to take care of themselves. We want them to be part of the bigger community. And for a lot of them, that does take a lot of work. Last year, almost 90% of them had addiction issues in addition to homelessness. They all had a mental health diagnosis, a lot of depression, a lot of PTSD. Almost all of our women and children have been through a lot of trauma from the way that they've grown up and the chaos that they've been living in.
And yet you said your success ratio was pretty high, I thought, in rehabilitation and getting these women and families back on their feet.
We're really proud of them. We have some really amazing families, really strong women. A lot of them, kind of what we were talking about earlier before we went on, a lot of them don't realize how strong they really are and how they need to be self-sufficient and empowered to take care of themselves and their children. They didn't grow up with that kind of, they didn't have that role model. They didn't grow up with somebody telling them, oh, you can do this. You know, you got this. So, yeah, if we can get people to come and to stay and to engage in the program, then we have a really successful track record, if you will. They really have to be ready to change. It's a lot like recovery. If they haven't made the decision that, oh, my gosh, I really need to make big changes, then, you know, it's a lot. We're asking them to change how they parent, you know, what they do all day, whether they're in school, whether they're working. I mean, we're asking them to change everything. So you have to be really committed to do that to be successful.
How long are they in the program for?
They can, our program has different components, and they can stay living in our facility up to 2 years. Most of them do not. The average length of stay is about 5 months. Our goal really for them is to get into permanent housing, and we help with that. We have some permanent housing. But then once they leave our program, they are still part of it. They're in aftercare, and they still can get the same services. They can see the therapist. Their kids can see the therapist. They can go to group. They get case management, some of it in home. They get all the same services for as long as they want. Because a lot of our families did not grow up with a support system and don't really have a solid support system. So, you know, they may want to be part of Sheffield Place for years, and that's fine.
And you said that the relationships they build in the while they're there are important mm-hmm. to them, and the children's interactions.
Yeah, we found that a lot of the women that we see, because we're a program for women with children, are younger women. The average age last year was 28. The year before that, though, it was only 22. So a lot of the women, they come in not realizing that they can, first of all, be self-sufficient and take care of themselves, but also that they can have support systems and friends who are women, who are there for them, who are just as strong and supportive. So we see a lot of friendships develop that end up being long-term. Once they move out, they still stay in contact. They still, you know, get together. They still babysit each other's kids, all that kind of stuff, which is really important. It's cool.
So is there a long waiting list to get into this? What is your...
As of a couple of days ago, since the beginning of 2014, we had 614 families on our wait list. And to date, we have served 43 in 2014. So we have a very lengthy wait list. Part of the reason we've really tried to shorten that length of stay is so that we get more people through the program and then keep more people on the aftercare side. We're currently, hopefully in January, starting construction where we're going to convert 3 laundry rooms to units, which will be much nicer than it sounds, converting laundry rooms, but that way we can serve 3 more families, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a 20% increase for us. And one of our donors pointed out to me when he said, you know, to one of those families, one of those 3 families, it's huge. It's completely worth doing. So we do have a long wait list, and it's increased the last 3 years substantially each year.
So there really is a lot of need for this service in our community, and this is probably the most I've heard of any shelter. I mean, this is more than a shelter. This is counseling. This is a whole life path program. Are there any other programs like this in the area?
Some of the other shelters, some of the other homeless programs provide some counseling. I don't believe that they have the expectation. I mean, we require that the women in our program go to at least 10 hours of services, clinical services a week on site. And so what that pretty much means is that they see a therapist once a week, case manager once a week, typically a family therapist once a week, and then go to group Monday through Thursday evenings and Saturday morning for 2 or 3 hours a night. So it's very intensive. And so for some people, they're not quite ready. For other people, they know that they really need to make changes, maybe to keep their kids with them, maybe to get out of an abusive situation, maybe to get clean and sober, but they know that they really have to do it this time. And so if they engage, they can really do well.
So once you have someone who is really committed to changing their life, you're not seeing as much return to homelessness once they've been released from the program?
No, we really don't. As I think I said that this current year, almost 90% of our families, of our moms, also had addiction issues. Periodically, we'll have somebody that relapses that needs to get back in at least for a while or needs to get into substance abuse treatment for a while. But we don't see a lot of them come back through.
They're able to find jobs and while they're in the program, are they get training or whatever they need?
That is probably the single most difficult thing is employment. A lot of our women have felonies, and so a lot of employers won't hire felons. A lot of them do not have GEDs or diplomas because they left school in sixth and seventh grade. So that's the most difficult thing. Right now we're really excited because we have three or four in the last couple of weeks that got jobs. So if they can get employment, then their futures are just so much more promising. It's really difficult right now because even in the service industry, a lot of them want you to have a GED or diploma. So that is a huge issue for our women. The goals that we have for all of our women are either increased employment or education, permanent housing, and that you're clean and healthy so that you're clean, you're sober, you have your health and mental health needs addressed, and those of your kids. So those are our goals for everybody when they come in.
This is making me wonder, how little can a woman and her children live on a month? I'm listening to this and I'm just shocked to think that these women are unable largely to find jobs.
We have women that, quite honestly, I'm not sure how they live. They don't have jobs, or they have jobs that are like kind of, maybe they clean houses a couple of days a week. They're very part-time, and they have very little cash coming in, and they manage to keep it together. I mean, it's a struggle. Poverty is a huge issue for our clients. One of the biggest things before we went on air that we were talking about that people can do is if they have any kind of employment opportunities at all. I mean, our women want to work, and they're very motivated. But that is it's a huge issue. I have a mom right now that works about 30 hours a week at a fast food restaurant. She rides the bus an hour and a half each way to work and back. And she has two kids. She, she struggles every day to make, food on the table, utilities paid, all that kind of stuff.
And you mentioned that many of them have food stamps and they have facilities where they prepare their own family meals on each floor.
Right. Our facility, each family has a two-room unit with their own restroom, and then there are three floors, and there's a kitchen on each floor that the families can cook their meals. Most of our women do receive food stamps. We were really excited in the state of Missouri when they decided that drug felons should be allowed to get food stamps and that they too should eat. So that was a huge, that was huge for our families. We do cooking classes and have a garden so that we can kind of show, fresh produce and how things make things go a little further. But the cooking, and that's kind of a way for the women to connect with each other too.
This just is such a big comprehensive thing, and then when you start talking about it, there's still a lot of holes. There's still a lot of gaps. You know, someone having to ride the bus an hour and a half one way to work, that seems still very much unacceptable.
Yeah.
And yet, what you're doing for them really is very comprehensive. And, I mean, most of the time when we talk about homelessness and homeless shelters, we're talking about repeat, return homelessness and chronic homelessness and, you know, 30-day limits of stay and all of this. And this is, you know, creating relationships with them.
Right.
But even with something like that, there's still more that the community as a whole could be doing.
Well, I think that, yes. I mean, on different levels, too. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about a little bit is food stamps. And it really, you know, I think that when people, okay, so as an example, Facebook. I think sometimes people post things on Facebook that they really have no idea what they're talking about. I don't know if you've all seen, but there's posts going around right now about how fabulous it is and what a great idea it is that we should drug test everybody before they get food stamps. And, you know, who should get food stamps. And I don't think that people realize when they talk about that kind of stuff, they're talking about who doesn't eat are children. Because, you know, a lot of times it's women and children who get food stamps.
Well, so, and, you know, we feed the people that are in prison. I mean, food is such a basic necessity. I mean, it borders on a right, mm-hmm. I would say. And so even when we're not realizing that it's children, I don't care how much you don't like the adult, that's food.
Right. Right, and we have a lot of women that come out of the Department of Corrections, and honestly, women that come out of there a lot of times are better equipped. Because in prison, a lot of times, they get their GEDs. They, you know, they are fed. They do get medical care. A lot of times, they have gone through some kind of training programs. So there are a lot of needs that are not being met.
Well, that's actually a little bit shocking, too. I mean, a lot of times we hear about our prison system, a high repeat offender rate, mm-hmm. because they're not really rehabilitating people. But you are seeing that there is some amount of success of some rehabilitative programs within our prison system.
I mean, the tiny piece that we see, a lot of times those women really do have some tools to be successful. So, yeah.
Well, then we've got some of the things that we need.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we've got a good idea. You've obviously, with your program, shown a really good idea of how to help people with homelessness. We just need to, you know, work together and get this all more universal, where we can have this be the way that homelessness is treated. It does seem very revolutionary.
Well, and we're, you know, we talk about that. We are a homeless shelter, but we also provide mental health services. We also provide recovery services, and we also provide intensive therapy for kids. So we're kind of we are an overlap for several different things. We don't really fit in any one, you know.
Well, but when you talk homelessness, almost every homeless shelter will say that they see the same people returning over and over again. And when their time expires at one shelter, they go to another until their time expires there and then come back to this one maybe. And you're saying we rarely see the people that leave here. It's a very, very, very big difference. I mean, what do you think, Sharon?
Well, I was able to attend the homelessness shelter, marathon when it was in Kansas City a few years ago, and I listened to homeless women and men talk about how hard it is to get out of that hole. Once you're in that homeless niche, it's so hard to come out of it. And sometimes these shelters, many of them, as I understand it, may just be providing them a place to sleep, and that's not enough. And what Sheffield Place is doing is going a step beyond and trying to help them learn how to integrate back into the world. But it's like the woman that has to travel an hour and a half on a bus to get to work. That's so impossible. Or the mother that has to get her children to school and is waiting at a bus stop. I've heard stories about that, about how difficult it is for these people because they don't have transportation, they don't have jobs. And to get a job, I mean, they're still so far in the hole that digging themselves out is just almost impossible.
Yeah, same thing with it's expensive to be poor.
Right,
right, very. And I think that, you know, there's a whole group of us in Kansas City that provide services to the homeless, and it's a continuum of care. You know, some people come in and they just need a bunk. They need a bunk and a meal for a couple nights or for 30 days or whatever they need, all the way down to who we serve, which is families that need lots of services for, you know, an amount of time so that they can move on. And so as a community, I think we're trying to fill that continuum with all the services that are needed. But there's just, as you pointed out, the need is just so great. I mean, we're not the only ones with, you know, a huge waiting list. So I think that the need is just so much greater than the resources at this point.
So what can members of the community do to assist? I mean, do you have volunteers come in? What is the community's relationship with you?
We, in the last 3 or 4 years, have worked really hard on that because we think it's important for our facility to be open to people coming in. Not only, I think, is it important for the community, but I think it's really important for our families to know that they're part of a bigger community and that there are a whole neighborhood of people that care about them and want them to succeed. So we have groups that come in and bring dinners and sit with the women and have dinner and play board games. So just like that social support piece. We have other groups that come in and do things in the children's program with the kids so that the kids can be around, you know, other adults and have that positive interaction with them, get attention, you know, all the things that are important when you're younger. We have a couple of corporations that come in and do mock interviewing with the women and talk to them about what can go on your resume and help them build resumes. So that's been really important. We have volunteers that come in and work on the facility. It's an old facility, so it needs lots of help. We have a big garden, so we have people that come in and work on that. So we really have been fortunate to have, you know, whether it's families, whether it's faith-based groups or corporations, there have been particularly a handful that have been with us and really stuck with us and just had a huge impact.
Well, let's pause for a moment. We've got one message that we need to play for you, and then we'll come back and talk about volunteering and...
Want to learn about what's going on in the Kansas City theater scene? Want to learn about what show you might like to attend? Join me, Michael Hogue, for the Arts Magazine program Mondays at 12 o'clock noon, right here on KKFI. We'll keep you fully informed.
All right, that was just a little bit of a brief message there. But I did want to kind of talk about volunteering and how people get involved, and particularly about volunteering around the holiday season. As I know, a lot of people really just get caught up in the holiday spirit and want to give their time and donate food and donate money, and they just get so caught up in what it means to be in the holiday season and what that maybe means for an organization that needs volunteers.
Okay. Well, first, I would absolutely say that we really appreciate our volunteers, and you're right. At the holidays, we're very fortunate that people will help take care of our families over the holidays, provide food. You know, as you said, I think people do get caught up in the spirit and have a moment to think why they're thankful and think about people that maybe aren't as fortunate. We, and I believe I speak for most of the agencies that provide services to folks, can use that help all year round. It is great during the holidays, but if we could harness all that energy and all that goodwill for the whole year, it would be fabulous. And I know people get busy and people have a lot on their plate, so I think that the holidays just is a big reminder to them that there are other people that need help. But we have, we're full. We're full. The only time we're not full is when one family's moving out and another's moving in. So the volunteer needs and the client needs are the same in March as they are in December. And so having, that's a great thing about this handful of volunteer kind of regulars that we have, is that they're there all through the year. So I think you're right. If people could think, oh, maybe the 25th of March would be a great time to volunteer too, the social service agencies would really appreciate that.
Well, you know, and that might be something that would be worthwhile of a New Year's resolution rather than a yearly holiday event, scheduling a monthly volunteer effort or, you know, and it doesn't have to be Sheffield Place.
Right. There are lots of places. Whatever your interest is, I think that you could find a volunteer job in Kansas City that would love to have you.
Or your money. Money is important.
Well, hey, let's talk about that then, too, because that is one of the things that people give. They don't just give their time,
right.
They give their money.
They do. Right. And again, the last 3 or 4 years, we've been really fortunate that we've had more and more support from individuals. And I'm sure, again, that other social service agencies would agree that the great thing about having individuals or families donate is that not only do you have that cash that you can use to operate your business, that, for example, pay for the lights. You know, you got to have lights. You got to have water. You know, you have to have all those things in a shelter. So individual donors give funds that are less restrictive, but you also then typically get the commitment of an individual or a family so that you have that support. You have somebody who has confidence in you. You have somebody that will tell their neighbors about you. You know, it's not, don't get me wrong, and I always tell people this, thank you for the cash. That's really helpful, but the relationship is what's most important for us.
And do you find that the cash donations are easier to come by in the holiday season, or do we get...
I think year-end.
Year-end?
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, look kind of at the year-end as far as where their donations are and where their tax situation is and all that. So the year-end is a time that a lot of not-for-profits do get individual donors, and again, it's much appreciated.
Well, and if you are someone who typically does... think about giving at this time of year, or if you think about giving all times of year, you can share your story with us. The number in the studio is 816-931-5534. We just want to talk about what we can do in our community, what Sheffield Place is doing for women and families, and, you know, what's the most... the best part about volunteering, the best part about giving.
You know, kind of in addition to the volunteering, we talked about this a little bit, but things that people can do is maybe think twice if you're hiring. If you're in a position where you hire people, think twice maybe about hiring somebody that's a little bit outside of who you would typically hire. I mean, a lot of our women may not have a GED, but they are very motivated, they're smart, you know, they're good employees. Same thing with if you own rental property. There is a huge need for, you know, good, clean, safe rental property for folks.
So is rental property hard to come by for these women?
Yes. Yes. That particularly that is safe, that's clean, that's a place where you would put a family. You know, and it's nice to have somebody who is a landlord who is supportive of that family and who, yeah, that's their business and they are absolutely, you know, running their business. They need that rent check, but they can be supportive of that family as well. And a lot of times these families are really good renters.
There might be people out there who are sitting on vacant properties that... has anybody ever donated free space?
You know, I would have been so remiss to forget that. One of the other things that we're doing is permanent housing. So we have a house that was donated to us by Kansas City, Missouri, and we've had a family, a mom and her two kids in there almost 2 years. She pays adjusted rent and utilities. It's a nice house. It's completely rehabbed, and we're using that model. We're just 2 weeks from now, closing on another house where we'll put another family in there for permanent housing. These are moms who are employed, who, you know, are responsible for their bills. So we are looking for, particularly in the northeast part of Kansas City, Missouri, housing that we can put families in, that we can make it affordable for them.
And I think there is a lot of housing that's owned by the city.
There is in the city, you know, we haven't talked about this a lot, but the city is a really great partner for us. The city is very supportive of services for homeless populations and really innovative in the way that they do provide services and provide support to us.
Well, I just got off of the line with a caller who, you know, speaking of Kansas City being a great place and all, they didn't want to make any comment on the air, but they were just loving this so much that they want to get in contact with you, and they have some things that they've been working on as well, and wanted you to say your name one more time.
Sure. My name is Kelly Welch, and I'm with Sheffield Place, and our phone number is 816-483-9927. And we also are, on, of course, on the web, and it's just sheffieldplace.org.
And let's spell that for them.
SHEFFIELDPLACE.org.
Is there a reason it's called Sheffield Place?
That's the neighborhood that we're in is Sheffield area.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. It's over just inside the 435 loop in the northeast. Yeah.
And Amy, I don't think we've discussed this. You said there was an interesting story behind the founding of Sheffield Place.
Yeah, the real need for shelter for women and children and services for them, which is interesting because, you know, as we grow those services and grow what we do and have expanded staff, we still have that huge need. So it's one of the things we're really working on. We're hoping to find an apartment building or a facility that we can get into, you know, not too expensively so that we can expand that facility, that on-site programming. One of the other things that we do that maybe there's somebody that would have an interest in helping with is that we have decided after working with these women for a while on employment that a lot of our clients are not going to be maybe good candidates for traditional employment. So we have a small cottage business where currently we're making soap and candles. But we're getting ready in 2015 to really focus on that and try and grow that, teach them real basic entrepreneurial skills, because we really think that a lot of our women are going to have maybe jobs like we talked about where they're in fast food, make an hourly wage that you really can't live on or support a family on, but if they supplement it, you know, they're going to be better off. So we're really kind of working on that piece as well.
Well, you know, one of the things on your website is that there are testimonials and stories from women
right.
who have been through there, and they are very powerful stories.
Mm-hmm.
People who are very open and candid about how bad they were at doing life prior to coming into the program and how much it changed them. And it's very,